Good morning and welcome. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Sonia Leite. Sarah Tinker, the usual minister, is away on a well-deserved day off. And so anyone who's new here, we welcome you to Essex Church, and we're known as the Kensington Unitarians. So our opening words this morning are by William R. Murray. These are the days that have been given to us. Let us rejoice and be glad in them. These are the days of our lives. Let us live them well in love and service. These are the days of mystery and wonder. Let us cherish and celebrate them in gratitude together. These are the days that have been given to us. Let us make of them stories worth telling to those who come after us. So let's start by lighting our chalice, the symbol of our worldwide Unitarian and Unitarian Universalist community. And Anthony will light the candle. This chalice. This is adapted by a poem by Alan G. Deal. The light of this chalice is a frail thing. It may flicker in the face of trouble and anxiety. It can be snuffed out by the winds of cynicism and apathy. May its little flame be a reminder of the power of the Spirit. Let us rededicate ourselves to providing light that lifts our hearts and increases the world's joy. So the theme of our worship today is Come What May. I certainly experienced that this morning when I couldn't get here. The buses weren't coming, the taxis weren't coming. And so this theme is all about, and the prayers and the hymns and the readings that Jane has compiled will be reflecting on our ability to give our best, regardless of the situation we find ourselves in. So it was very apt. Thank you. And this is a congregational service, so it's not only led by me, but it's led by the whole community here today.
Walking Toward Morning by Victoria Sufford. You know, we do it every day. Every morning, we go out blinking into the glare of our freedom, into the wilderness of work and the world, making maps as we go, looking for signs that we're on the right path. And on some good days, we walk right out of our oppressions, those things that press us down from the outside, or as often from the inside. We shake off the shackles of fear, prejudice, timidity, closed-mindedness, selfishness, self-righteousness, and claim our freedom outright, terrifying as it is, our freedom to be human and humane. Every morning, every day, we leave our houses, not knowing if it will be for the last time, and we decide what we'll take with us, what we'll carry, how much integrity, how much truth-telling, how much compassion, in case somebody along the way might need some, how much arrogance, how much anger, how much humour, how much willingness to change and be changed, to grow and be grown. How much faith and hope, how much love and gratitude. You pack these with your lunch and medications, your diary and your papers. Every day, we gather what we think we'll need, pick up what we love, and all that so far believe. Put on our history, shoulder our experience and memory, take inventory of our blessings, and we start walking toward morning.
The Labour of Living by Geoffrey Lockwood. In maths class, I was admonished to show my work, and in English, I had to turn in my rough drafts. As a student, these seemed like perverse requirements. What difference did it make how I arrived at the correct algebraic solution or the well-crafted paragraph? Now that I'm a professor, I appreciate the value of seeing the labour that goes into a final product. A colleague in engineering once told me that such an approach smacked of making excuses. In engineering, there's no partial credit. You don't get paid half of a contract if you build a bridge that collapses under half the specified load. Fair enough, there is something to be said for standards. But another reason for seeking the work that went into the essay or equation is that it tells me what went wrong. If I'm a good enough teacher, I can help the student avoid the error in the future. What's more, I can see the student's effort and decide how to allocate my time amongst those needing help. It sounds callous, but it's quite the opposite. Witnessing the struggle of my students has deepened my compassion. Early on, as a naive assistant professor, I told my students that I'd match their efforts at learning with my own teaching. I imagined that their shortcomings were invariably due to a lack of self-discipline, a mental laziness, a failure to devote themselves to scholarship. Often I was right, but in time I learned that when I was wrong, I was tragically wrong. I realised that I will never be able to match the blood, sweat and tears shed by many of my students in their pursuit of learning and life. I've come to know the schizophrenic pupil who managed to learn while his mind wrestled with insane thoughts muffled by psychotropic drugs. And the sleepy-eyed student, who was not a party animal, but rather a single father nursing his feverish child after the mother walked out on them. A young woman arrived in my classroom late and out of breath, not because she was irresponsible, but because she'd been battling through a heart-pounding anxiety attack that left her gasping for air as she left her apartment. One student, who had escaped the suffocating smallness of her rural high school, fought the urge to drown her insecurities in alcohol while holding back tears of frustration with the problems I assigned. Another young scholar had abdominal pains that were so agonising that her mind alternated between my reading assignments and thoughts of suicide. She was eventually forced to drop out of school and was later diagnosed with a rare intestinal disorder. What if everyone showed their work? What if I knew how much struggle that waitress had gone through during exhausting weeks of relearning to walk after a stroke? Or how much turmoil went into the bookkeeper's efforts to leave her house without checking the door dozens of times in the grip of an obsessive-compulsive disorder? Or how much gut-wrenching anxiety went into a co-worker's battle to begin his day without that pill, powder, or injection? I might be willing to leave the waitress a generous tip despite mixed up orders, to overlook a mistyped purchase order, or to wait patiently for a reply to an unanswered mail. But I have the right to maintain some sort of standard of performance and adhere to a minimal measure of quality, right? Or maybe if I knew the labours of others' lives, I'd apply that standard of performance to my own humanity. And that measure of quality to my own soul.
A reading from Expect Chaos by Vanessa Rush Southern. I used to think life could be counted on to be stable. It was my parents' fault. They carefully engineered my world to send just that message. My evening bedtime was the same. The lunch my mother packed every day was basically the same. The way my father did my hair every morning was one of two very predictable styles. Every day, without fail, there was someone in the queue outside school to pick me up. Things moved along with amazing certainty. A predictable life does a child good in many ways. It makes the world feel safe. It frees us up to concentrate on important things like schoolwork and figuring out who we are. Yet, I've come to see that life, unlike the routines of my childhood, is not predictable. A few weeks ago, I found myself saying something I had said many times before. When this chapter, snag, transition is over, life will begin again. My husband chimed in from the corner of the room to say, "Haven't we been saying some version of that for 5 years now?" Indeed, we both realized perhaps we'd been duped. Perhaps this is life. Perhaps change is life. Frustrations and snags are life. Maybe instead of being taught to expect stability and predictability, we should have been taught to expect chaos, or at least constant transitions and snags. We should have been told that turbulence in the air is the norm, not the exception. Keep your air sickness bags close, ladies and gentlemen. This ride will be shaky. The theologian, Sharon Walsh, was interviewing women managers a few years back, trying to find out what approach made some more successful, gave some more professional longevity. What she found was that the women who survived and thrived in their jobs were the ones who didn't take chaos personally. The women who thrived were the ones who didn't think they had failed when things went wrong at work. Instead, they were the ones who came to work asking, "What will it be today?" and then looked around to find out what it would be. Physics tells us there is a chaos in the cosmos, in every atom, in the wanderings of every electron. Why should our existence be any different? So, here is our new life philosophy, or at least part of it. Expect, watch for, and embrace uncertainty. Dance with the madness of the cosmos, not against it. Leave your door open and your heart ready for anything. In this adult world, it may be the only way, not just to survive what is inevitable, but to thrive in the midst of it.
This is a reading, Feeding the Pit, by Barbara Merritt. Part of the advantage of having an elevator being installed 2 feet from my office door is that I can easily listen to the construction crew's conversation. It echoes up from the 2 floors below. It rings down the hallway, and in between the drilling, the chain rattling, the pounding, and the sawing comes some helpful theological reflection. This particular conversation occurred between a man who was balanced on a 45-degree ladder over a 3-story open elevator pit and the man assisting him. The man on the ladder, who gave me greater appreciation for having been called to the ministry, asked for 4 bolts. His colleague said, and I quote, "I'll give you 5. You need to have 1 to feed the pit." Now, I can only surmise that this wisdom had been hard won. People who work over great cavities of air have probably learned through experience about gravity. Objects fall. They will fall a great distance when there is nothing to stop them. Ergo, if you are going to suspend yourself over a deep pit, don't assume that everything will go perfectly. Don't assume that a nut or a bolt won't roll away. Assume that additional resources will come in handy. Acknowledge the challenging nature of the assignment. take a relationship with the pit where you willingly and gracefully accept that it will occasionally be need to fed. It will occasionally need to be fed. That was my pit. The alternative is simply too costly. To assume that things will go smoothly, that hammers won't drop, that nails won't bend, that parts won't wander, is to place yourself in a special danger, especially when your workplace is at the top of a ladder suspended over a 50-foot drop. Pits are real. Some places in human existence pose genuine danger. Illness, conflict, and accidents can quickly take everything we hold as precious. Well, some people advise, don't look down. Pretend that nothing bad could ever happen to you or anyone you love. This is the ignore the pit school. Another popular option is to decry the pit. Oh, isn't it terrible that there are pits in the world? Ain't it awful that I've fallen in? Many allegedly smart people have spent their entire lives arguing about why pits exist and justifying how angry and offended and angry they are that dangerous places continue to exist. Some become profoundly cynical when they discover how painful a pitfall can be. Oh, what's the use, they sigh. With so much destruction and unhappiness in the past and so much possible misery in the future, why build at all? They become paralyzed with fear. At the moment, I'm drawn to the simple teaching of the elevator man. Feed the pit. Right from the beginning, I should expect to encounter danger, demons, difficulties, and delays on the journey. We need to build a generous contingency fund into every life plan and carry a few extra rations of energy, kindness, and hope in our pockets to offer to an unpredictable and hungry world.
Next, also by Barbara Merritt. My friend Steve claims that his philosophy of life has finally been simplified to the extent that it could be expressed in one word, next. Whatever the challenge in his life might be, he wants to be ready to meet it. Whatever he wakes up to, whether in his professional life, relationships, errands, or health conditions, Steve wants to have the same poise and balance as a man behind the bakery or deli counter welcoming his next customer with the friendly greeting, next, next. What bewildering, demanding assignments has life given me to accomplish today? What completely outrageous problem must I find a way to solve? Whether it's a leak in the plumbing, a funny noise in the car engine, or the realization that it's no longer possible to put off paying the bills, I like the idea of simply facing the task that presents itself. All that is required is an open heart, a curious mind, and a willingness to engage with reality. There are, of course, alternative ways to view the world. One of my personal favourites is to hope each morning when I open my eyes that the day will go smoothly. Smoothly being defined as nothing interfering with my pre-existing plans. No unpleasant delays, and especially no events that make me aware of my dependency or limitations. If you approach daily life with the expectation that nothing ought to interfere with your own predilections and preferences, you are likely to resist and reject much of what happens. Resisting what is real, fighting with reality, getting angry and depressed with what is exhausting and ultimately a losing battle. Reality has a persistent way of showing up on your doorstep. You can waste a whole lot of time wishing reality was simpler and less demanding, but the ever-changing circumstances of this life keep presenting themselves to us. The critical question is, how will we respond? Now, I don't have the temperament or the religious maturity to greet every challenge with peaceful composure or to delight in whatever is God's will. I don't have the unselfishness or the trust to welcome each new disruption with an optimism that declares this too can be conquered or made workable. But I love the image of someone behind a counter yelling out, next, determined to offer what service and talent are available when a new proverbial customer appears. As I get older, I find I must ask life's challenges to get in line and take a number. I fully expect that some of the customers will be difficult, and some will bring a gracious blessing. Some of the changes ahead will bring astonishing new life. Some will break my heart. And when one challenge appears to have been met and fully addressed, I am confident that the next challenge is waiting in the wings. Euripides wrote 2,500 years ago, "All is change, all yields its place and goes. Then we find ourselves face to face with the mystery of whatever comes next."
All Will Be Well by Meg Barnhouse. All will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well. This is one of the mantras used in the Christian meditation tradition. Don't think it comes from a dewy-eyed Pollyanna. The woman to whom it is credited, Dame Julian of Norwich, is the same one who, when her mule got stuck on a mountain road in a rainstorm, dismounted, shook her fist at the sky, and shouted, "God, if this is how you treat your friends, it's no wonder you don't have many." Lately, I have been experimenting with repeating, "All will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well." I try it out in different situations. Sometimes I feel stupid affirming that all will be well. What about the things that aren't well and don't look like they're ever going to be well? It's hard to see the whole picture from where I stand at this moment in life. There's a story of a Chinese farmer who had a fine horse show up in his pasture one day. "How marvelous," all the neighbors said. "Maybe," said the farmer. His son tried to ride the horse, and the horse threw him, breaking the son's leg. "Awful," said the neighbors. "Maybe," replied the farmer. Then the emperor's army came through town to draft young men for war. The farmer's son was spared because of his broken leg. I can't tell in the grand scheme of things whether things are turning out well or not. To affirm that all will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well, is difficult for me. There are child abusers, and torturers, and AIDS, and oil spills, and a multitude of other horrors in the world. Here is what I do know. I know that I have a choice between hope or despair when viewing the world and my future. Each choice has equal evidence in its favor. Each is affirmed and underscored by my life experience. How do I decide between them? I choose the one that brings the most joy, the most healing, the most compassion to my life and to the world. In despair, I'm no good to anyone. I stop functioning well. I drag through the days. I deal with horrors that haven't even happened yet. I don't enjoy my children, food, sex, or any of the other dazzling pleasures of my life. When my mother was dying of cancer, she said to me, "Maggie, everything that happens to me is good." That was a statement of her faith. I was a cynical 23-year-old seminary study. My mother's face sounded naive and silly. I was in despair over her suffering, but she was not in despair. It was her suffering. Suddenly, it seemed presumptuous to despair over her suffering when she was choosing not to. As I experiment with this mantra and risk feeling stupid, which is a feeling I despise, I ask myself, which is more stupid? To despair my whole life just in case things aren't going to end well, or to live in joy and hope my whole life, whether or not things turn out too well? I'm going to keep singing this mantra to my fears. All will be well, and all will be well, and all manner of things will be well.
This is When Life is Messy by Richard S. Gilbert. It's easy to pray when the sun shines and we're grateful for another glorious day of being. It's hard to pray when wind and rain and thunder plague our every step and spoil our every plan. It's easy to be virtuous when life goes well and our existence is a journey from bliss to beauty and back. It's hard to be virtuous when life assaults us and our very being is a pilgrimage from bad to worse to worst. It's easy to be cheerful when health bursts in us so that we can feel the very pulse of life. It's hard to be happy when pain and fatigue beset us and we wonder if we can go on. It's easy to do good when our goodness is rewarded and we feel the power of pride in our accomplishment. It's hard to do good when we suffer for our efforts and are troubled because we have been misunderstood. It's easy to feel religious impulses well up inside us when inspiration lives at our elbow and walks on our path. It is hard to feel religious when we are tired with work to be done and discouragement seems to mark our every move. O God of order and neatness, we give thanks for all that is good. We're grateful for manifold blessings bestowed upon us. O God of chaos and disorder, be with us also when life is messy. Bless our coming in and our going out from this day forth. And now we take our leave. Before we gather here again, may each of us bring happiness into another's life. May we each be surprised by the gifts that surround us. May each of us be enlivened by constant curiosity. And may we remain together in spirit till the hour we meet again. Amen.